This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm delighted now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Fred Nathan. He's executive director of Think New Mexico, which is an independent public policy think tank based right here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Mary Charlotte, thank you again for having me back on your show.
It's a great pleasure. And I love Think New Mexico because, I mean, you describe yourself as a results-oriented think tank, and indeed, you have an excellent track record identifying problems and then seeing to it that they get solved. We're talking today about your newest initiative, which is about capital outlay reform or infrastructure funding, or what we affectionately call PORC. Tell us what this is. I mean, this is something that is a long-term New Mexico legislative set of ideas, laws, problems, practices. What does the current system look like in New Mexico? How did it come to be?
So, and when we talk about infrastructure, we're talking about things like state roads, like St. Francis Drive, university classrooms, water systems, dams, bridges, those sorts of things. And the system actually goes back to 1977, and specifically to when there was 2 days left in the session. And prior to that, when the legislature funded public infrastructure projects, there would just be a single bill for a single project, and it would go through both chambers just like any other bill. But with 2 days to go in that session, the Senate Finance Committee decided to pull together the 27 bills having to do with funding public infrastructure, and they put them into a single massive bill, over $100 million, and they called it the Christmas tree bill, as in, if this passes, every legislator will get a present for their district. And just so that point wasn't lost on any legislator, they actually formatted the front page of the bill in the shape of a tree. And not surprisingly, it passed unanimously, which is hard to do, you know, pass anything in 2 days. And it's become something of a tradition, and they've passed a Christmas tree bill to fund public infrastructure every year since then. And your listeners may recall in this last session, they weren't able to get it done, so they brought it into a special session. And it was about $295 million, which is sort of typical. We went back and researched the cost of these bills, and they've averaged over the last 15 years just about that amount, $300 million. So that's how we fund public infrastructure. The problem is that it's done in a very hyper-political way. And Governing Magazine has ranked us second to the bottom in their rankings of this. A professor from the University of Illinois who's made this his life's work.
I love that there's a magazine called Governing Magazine.
And it's only me and a few other policy wonks that read it. I can't understand how they're able to stay in business, but somehow they make it. And this is the sort of thing that they look at. Michael Pagano, professor at University of Illinois, has said this is New Mexico is the textbook example of how not to allocate resources to capital infrastructure. And it's not just people on the outside, Mary Charlotte, it's people on the inside, like Senator Pete Campos has actually wrote his PhD thesis on this subject and called our process hyper-political and archaic. And I wouldn't disagree. And I think what many of them are referring to is we're the only state that actually allocates money to specific legislators. So, for example, in this last session, every senator was given $1 million to spend in their sole discretion. Every House member was given $600,000. And if you do the math, that's $84 million out of a bill that was $295 million. And these allocations get spent on things like football helmets, band uniforms, sculpture gardens, which was something that was actually appropriated here in Santa Fe.
What's wrong with that?
Well, what's wrong with that is that in many cases, I mean, we have about a $4 billion backlog of urgently needed bigger projects. So, for example, just to give you one example, it's not terribly sexy, but the forensics lab at the Department of Public Safety is in jeopardy of losing its accreditation because of the state of its physical plant. And that can't ever seem to get funded, but yet we're funding some of these other things that I think most people wouldn't consider a necessity. Another example I like to use, but I hesitate with you, Mary Charlotte, knowing that you're a big lover of dogs, is that, you know, recently they appropriated $50,000 for a doggy drinking fountain for a park in Las Cruces. Yet there are thousands of people in New Mexico who don't have access to safe drinking water, and a lot of communities that could use new water systems. So that $84 million, some of it was spent, and I don't want to say that all of it's spent on pork, but much of it could be spent on higher priority needs. The other really big problem here is that because this is a system without any planning or vetting or objective criteria, that in many cases, when the money is appropriated, the legislators haven't put sufficient funding in. So much of the money sits idle on the sidelines. In fact, the legislature's own budget staff did a study looking at the Christmas tree bills from 2, 3, and 4 years ago, which combined spent a little less than $500 million, but more than $300 million, actually $311 million, is still sitting idle on the sidelines because many of these projects aren't shovel-ready. That's bad for two reasons. I mean, obviously, we have so many unmet needs. But secondly, when you think about jobs, and we're 50th of the 50 states in job growth, and every $100 million equates to about 2,700 jobs. So that's about 8,100 jobs, good-paying jobs with benefits, that are just sitting on the table because of this sort of grab-bag approach without planning or objective criteria.
So that is the kind of theoretical overview, and there are many examples. Let's talk about some of those examples. There are unfinished buildings. There are dams that leak. Tell us about some of these.
One very good example, and I hesitate to pick individual projects because I don't want people to think that I'm picking on their community or a single legislator, but one example that we profiled in the report is the Mora County Courthouse, which is, they tore down the old courthouse there, and they assumed that they were going to need $10 million, which is a lot of money for a courthouse for such a small community. But they didn't have the money because, again, these legislators, they'll get $1 million or $600,000, and many of them engage in what has been referred to as layaway funding. So they find a worthy project, but they don't have the money, so they appropriate money year after year that just sits there waiting, and they underestimated the cost of the courthouse. I mean, originally they thought it was going to be, I think, about $5 million. Now they're, I think, up to $10 or $12 million, and it's still not finished. So they tore down the courthouse. The people that are supposed to be working there are now in portables. The building still isn't finished because they lack the funds. So that would be, you know, one example.
Why did the estimate go up so much of what the building would cost?
Well, because they took so long to do the layaway funding plan that with inflation, I think the price went up, and I think they underestimated the cost on the front end. And, you know, there were no bad intentions here. That was actually, I think, a well-intended project. But again, when you do it in this way and you just do the funding 1 year at a time, you run into problems like this. Whereas the way other states do it is they have a more, well, first of all, they come up with a statewide plan and they use objective criteria like health and safety and urgency. And they plan many years in advance. Most states have like a 5-year plan. So a project like that, they would have said, well, this is going to take 2 or 3 years. They would have estimated professionally with engineers and architects on the front end instead of a political guesswork. So I think that would be a good example of why the system doesn't really serve New Mexicans very well.
So that's an example of a project that is desperately needed. I mean, the idea that there's a county where your court is happening in trailers and there's a torn down building and no new building. I mean, it's crazy. There are other kinds of projects. There was one that was covered on the news, and it's on your website, about a building that was bought for a Spanish flamenco arts company, but nobody seemed to really notice that the building was not in shape to house anything. It was falling apart and eventually was torn down, and the whole thing cost taxpayers $500,000 for nothing. How can that happen? I mean, who dropped the ball?
I'm glad you brought that example up, because it underscores another problem with the way we do this, which is the complete and total lack of transparency with the capital outlay bill. What happens is, towards the end of the session, the legislators are told, okay, you'll be receiving $1 million. You've put in requests for many times that. Give us on a piece of paper how you want to spend that $1 million. And that's not available to the public. In fact, there are no public hearings. And so when you pass legislation without public input, not to mention not having the local mayors or county commissioners having an ability to comment, you run into really bad projects like this. And, you know, in contrast to that, when they pass the budget, there are public hearings, and sometimes those hearings are all over the state, and people are invited to comment, and a lot of bad ideas are deterred by that transparency. Here, all you need to do, if you want to get something into the Christmas tree bill, is to hire a well-connected lobbyist who's friends with one legislator. And since the legislators can spend this money in their sole discretion, you can get your project funded, and you don't have to defend it in public as you do with any other bill, and it has to stand up to some level of public scrutiny. Here, there's no public scrutiny.
In that case, the whole thing would have not been a disaster if any one person had actually gone into the building, right?
Correct.
So, and one ends up thinking, was this building owned by somebody's cousin who was trying to offload it on the taxpayers?
The cities and the local governments are very frustrated by this Christmas tree process, because they do submit a list to the legislature every year of like their top five priorities. And invariably what we hear when we talk to county commissioners and city councilors and mayors is that the bill comes out. And so, for example, in this last session, the bill wasn't even posted online until the session concluded. So here you have all these city councilors and county commissioners going through the bill after it's been passed, looking for the projects that they've prioritized, and invariably none of them are on there, but something that they didn't request is on there, and now they've got to figure out how to pay for the heating and cooling of this new structure, the maintenance, the staffing, that they don't have money for. So it's sort of a double whammy. They're not getting what the priorities are, but they're getting these other things that really aren't urgently needed.
There are also examples, I think, of projects that have been started and then the money isn't there to complete them. And so New Mexico has unfinished, for example, senior centers or other kinds of government buildings that are just sitting there and that are going to be ruined because an unfinished building is no good.
And that's very, very common, where they'll make an appropriation for $100,000 for an engineering study or architectural plans. They come back, so they spend $100,000, and then the legislator either loses his seat or loses interest in the project. So we have these wonderful architectural plans for a structure that never gets built.
We're talking to Fred Nathan of Think New Mexico. Now, on a national level, we have a situation which I think everybody understands, which is, because of our campaign finance laws, huge amounts of money is spent in a very unequal way for political campaigns, and the losers in that are the citizens. The winners are the people who, for example, make campaign ads. They get rich.
Right.
Is there anybody benefiting from this capital outlay process the way it works in New Mexico?
The biggest winners are lobbyists, and that's because it's difficult to pass legislation. But in this case, as I alluded to earlier, if you're a lobbyist and a client comes to you and they say, we want to get $500,000 for our project or for a not-for-profit, they just hire a lobbyist. The lobbyists, really, it's very easy for them. They have many friends in the legislature. They just need to find a single legislator who will put it on their list. And then they don't have to do all the other work that you normally have to do to pass a bill and talk to the other 111 legislators. You just, you know, take a legislator to lunch sometimes and persuade them to put it in the bill, and your work is done. So the lobbyists do very well from this system, and they really profit from that lack of transparency. They would be the biggest losers if we move to what we're proposing, a more merit-based system. Then you wouldn't have these middlemen, lobbyists, profiting so much from the Christmas tree bill.
How does the public school funding work in the state of New Mexico, and how does that funding, because that's part of our state infrastructure, fit into this whole set of questions that you are bringing up?
That's a great question, and we looked at that, and that is really the model that we looked at, and that's part of the solution. So just for background for your listeners, about 15 years ago, there was a lawsuit brought by the Zuni School District in western New Mexico, and they pointed out that under the state constitution, every child is guaranteed an adequate education. But they pointed out that because their tax base is so low and so much of the land out there is owned by the federal government, that they couldn't generate enough money to maintain their schools, and that they were unsafe. And in many cases, they couldn't open the doors at the beginning of the school year. So they brought a very clever lawsuit, which they prevailed in. And that caused the legislature to look at the system of funding public school construction in New Mexico. And the legislature really deserves a lot of praise because they came up with a extremely smart system that drained all the politics out and did it on merit. So what they did was they put together a panel of experts to basically rank the 850 school buildings in New Mexico from the most deficient to the least deficient. And when they started, when this bill passed, remarkably, over 70% of the schools in New Mexico, the actual buildings, were deficient in some way.
What kind of ways?
So asbestos, heating and cooling problems, mold, leaking roofs, everything that you can think of with your house that can go wrong, goes wrong in school buildings. And today that number has been whittled in half. It's now about 35%. And it's because the money is being spent so intelligently and so efficiently, and they have objective criteria. And it really doesn't matter whether your school building is in the district of a powerful legislator or a, you know, first termer, it's done completely based on need and health and safety, which is at the top of the objective criteria. And it's a very well-administered program. So essentially all we're saying is, why don't we do the rest of our capital infrastructure spending in New Mexico the way we do school construction? And so we've drafted a bill essentially modeled after that system.
So tell us more about that bill and what that looks like.
Okay, so when we talk to legislators about this, you know, naturally many of them like the current system because it's fun to get $1 million that you can spend on whatever you want. And they legitimately say, you know, the Constitution says that we have the power of the purse, and we should be driving the bus in how this money is spent. So at the we've created a three-tier system. At the top is a legislative oversight committee made up of 18 members of the legislature who will be responsible for setting up those objective criteria, things like urgency and health and safety and shovel readiness and so forth.
Now, how are these people chosen? Is it consciously bipartisan? How does that work?
Bipartisan and with equal representation with the House and the Senate. And they would be the members of that oversight committee, as with other committees, would be selected by the leaders with those constraints that it be bipartisan, of course, and with equal representation for the House and Senate. So that the legislature would create, in effect, a scoring system, maybe from 0 to 100, where they would decide how many points should be awarded to a project for health and safety, as just one example. And they would oversee a panel of what we call a council of experts, half appointed by the executive, half appointed by the legislature. And it'd be sort of a Noah's Ark of experts. You'd have 2 architects, 2 engineers, 2 builders, two people, you know, familiar with complex financial transactions. And the chairs would be the Secretary of the Department of Finance and Administration and the Legislative Finance Committee. So again, very even-handed between the executive and the legislature, since they are co-equal branches of government. And then the bottom tier would be the Department of Finance and Administration, who would vet projects that would come in from cities, counties, state agencies, just to make sure that they make sense on the front end before they get scored by this council of experts. And another thing, you know, that the legislature has said to us that they're concerned about is that these projects would be geographically diverse, that we wouldn't just be funding projects in Albuquerque. So again, that's something that the legislature can do through their oversight committee, is to mandate that the Christmas tree bill going out would continue to be geographically diverse, and that we wouldn't overlook some of these smaller, poor rural communities, which I would argue actually in a merit-based system would probably do much better, because the needs are much greater than they are in these smaller communities.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, if the current system isn't working, I mean, the rural-urban divide is not really an issue. It's not working in either set of communities.
That's exactly right. I wish you were in the legislature.
The idea of looking at projects and ranking them according to, for example, as you said, public health and safety, scheduling, financing, goals, and I don't know. I mean, there's a thing that you might call importance. How do you rank that?
Again, we're going to defer to the legislature to decide how to create a scoring system that reflects or mirrors the priorities of the legislature. But the way most states do it is they have a scoring system, for example, from 0 to 100. The doggy drinking fountain might not score so well on health and safety and urgency, but maybe get some points for quality of life. But other projects, like getting a community that lacks a water system, that would score pretty high. So that's generally how these work in other states. One thing that we looked at all 50 states and how they do this. The states that Governing Magazine ranked very, very high were Utah and Oklahoma. And interestingly, Oklahoma, the legislature themselves decided that the plan, which would be developed by a council of experts, would go to the legislature, and the legislature could not add projects, but they could subtract projects. And that's a system that was graded very highly by Governing Magazine.
Very interesting. Another way that projects get funded is through bonds. For example, when we vote on a school bond or a recreation or senior center bond or all kinds of bonds. That's a way that some infrastructure gets funded. How does that relate to all the rest of this?
That's a great question. And the short answer is those are general obligation bonds, and those go to the voters, as opposed to the Christmas tree bill, which is mostly supported by severance tax bonds. And that's simply where you borrow against, the state borrows against the taxes that the state receives off of minerals that are severed from the earth, like oil and gas and coal. And because the general obligation bonds go to the voters, the legislature usually picks things that they know voters will vote in favor of. So, for example, higher education, university classrooms, or there's always one for libraries, there's usually one for senior citizen centers. The more controversial projects go into the Christmas tree bill because, again, that doesn't go to the voters, doesn't go to the public. The public doesn't get to vote on it. And that's another complicating feature, I would say, of the Christmas tree bill is that there is a predisposition to put in the more controversial type projects into the Christmas tree bill.
Is there redundancy sometimes between what kind of bonds get voted on by voters and things that are in the Christmas tree bill? I mean, is there any kind of balances, ways of coordinating those things?
There is that rough division between projects that are sort of mom and apple pie, university classrooms, senior citizen centers, and everything else. And the everything else is what gets dropped into the Christmas tree bill. That's a really good question. I need to think about that some more and look into that, how they, other than that rough approximation, how they divide those projects. I actually don't know the answer to that question.
We're talking to Fred Nathan of Think New Mexico. We're going to take a little break. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned to the Radio Cafe. We're back with Fred Nathan, Executive Director of Think New Mexico, New Mexico's independent public policy think tank, and we're talking about capital outlay and pork, and I love the word pork because it is my favorite meat, but the system is not working very well. Now, you have basically, what, put together a bill that will be considered this coming legislative session?
Correct. We're still working on identifying the right sponsors. We always have a Democrat and Republican in both the House and the Senate. And it's a 30-day session, which makes it even more challenging. And, you know, you gave us that wonderful wind-up at the beginning about how we're results-oriented. I think this is probably the most challenging project that we've ever taken on in the sense that it is, you know, something that the legislature really holds dear, this system.
I mean, I understand that they might hold it dear because any legislator coming home with $1 million for their district or $600,000 for their district is going to be, you know, is going to be happy and the constituents are going to be happy. But is that the make or break when that candidate is up for re-election?
That's very insightful. A lot of these legislators, when we talk to them, they do view it that way. They think it's critical for their reelection. And we're skeptical because when you look into the proposals, on average, we discovered that for every 8 projects that are submitted to legislators, they can only fund 1. And I've never run for political office, but I would think the math isn't in the elected officials' to their advantage, because for every 1 person you make happy, there's 7 people that you have to turn down. And so I wouldn't think that would actually be so good for their reelection. And we cited in our report the example of George Buffett. This was a legislator who served for many terms from the Northeast Heights of Albuquerque, who on principle didn't want to involve himself with this system, and he never accepted his appropriation because he thought the whole thing was tainted. And he never had trouble getting reelected. Now, that's anecdotal. That's just one legislator. But we think it's something of a myth that this is what's critical to their election. But it also brings up the point, Mary Charlotte, as to whose money is it? And, you know, one legislator, when our report came out, it got covered in the New Mexican, and a local legislator said, well, but this is how we get reelected. And a friend of mine called up and said, does he think it's his money? Because it's the public's money. And I think that's one of the issues that's going to be hashed out with this bill is it money that's there to subsidize the reelection of legislators' campaigns, or is this money that should be used and put to its highest and best needs for the public?
I would like to see some research in which voters are asked if they know how much money came to their district and what it was used for. Because I will tell you, and I try to keep on top of these things, I have not the foggiest idea of what's going on in my district with respect to capital outlay.
You and me both. I mean, I'm a policy wonk. This is what I do all day long. And I couldn't tell you what projects were funded by the Christmas tree or general obligation bonds. And I'm generally not aware, until we started doing this report, of how this money is being spent. And and to be fair, not every legislator really believes that it's critical to their reelection. I was visiting with Brian Egoff yesterday, and we had a really good conversation about this. And he's skeptical, as I am, that the Christmas tree bill is essential to incumbents' reelection.
I think this whole question of pork and capital outlay and all of this brings up some really interesting questions about this speaks to something that I've been observing in terms of the way people talk about government, and they talk about big government and small government, and that basically maps on to high taxes or lower taxes. And I think that is an inaccurate metaphor of ways of looking at government, because let's say that you've got $500 million to spend. You've got $500 million to spend. That's a lot of money. Oh, big government. If you spend it in ways that are very efficient and very well thought out, the public is happy because the public has things that it needs. It has dams that don't leak. It has courthouses. It has schools with roofs that don't leak, things like that. If you waste that money or spend it improperly because you don't have good systems in place, then people complain, but it's the same amount of money. So it's not really big or small. It's like I was thinking, you know what? I've been racking my brain. What's a metaphor for this? And I came up with an LED light bulb and an incandescent light bulb. They're the same size. They generate the same amount of light. One of them takes way more energy than the other. So with that same amount of energy that it takes to power one incandescent light bulb, you can power six LEDs. The same holds true for government.
That's a great metaphor. In fact, I think I'd like to borrow that when I go lobby this with the legislature. And you're right. You know, when I talk to, you know, whether it's big government, you know, liberals or small government conservatives, the level of outrage, I would say, is the same between them. I think everybody across the state, if you just ask them generally, are outraged when they understand how this money is being spent. And everybody wants to see it spent more intelligently and try to eliminate pork altogether, if at all possible. So that's really the, you know, the interesting thing about this is if you polled on this, I'm sure the support for a merit-based, transparent system would be in the upper 90s. And that sort of points out the sort of the disconnect if we're not able to pass this. Because, you know, I'm talking to people in labor unions, business groups, and they are uniformly in favor and believe that this system is completely broken. And that's, you know, our job at Think New Mexico is to get these other voices to the legislature. So when the bill does get heard, I think we'll be able to show, you know, we've got support from, you know, all the way from the League of Women Voters on the left to the Rio Grande Foundation, which is a libertarian group here in New Mexico that also supports this. So hopefully we can persuade our legislators to just simply listen to their constituents about this and appreciate the need for this reform.
One of the, as you said, one of the losers in this would be lobbyists, which I don't think a whole lot of people are going to cry their eyes out about,
no,
except for the lobbyists themselves, who are sort of an odd interest group if you think about it that way. But another loser in the system the way it is now is the taxpayer who has to pay for special sessions when these capital outlay bills don't get passed during the regular legislative session.
We were surprised when we went back and did the research on this. We looked at the last 20 sessions and counted up 6 special sessions where the primary motive for the special session was to pass this capital outlay bill. And we asked ourselves, you know, why are these bills more and more getting pushed off to the special session? And I think it's when you have a system without any objective criteria, it becomes a political test of wills, sometimes between the legislature and the executive, sometimes between Democrats and Republicans. And you're right, the biggest losers currently are all of us, because not only do we get these wasteful bills, but we get to pay more for a special session for them to pass it. So you're right, the biggest winners, if we can get a merit-based system passed in the session, would be the public, and the biggest losers would be the lobbyists.
So legislators seem to be attached to it only because they think that it wins them re-election, or they like to have this purse and spend it. I mean, one would think that they would be happy to have a more functional system.
Yeah, I think it's all of the above. And you know, there are some legislators who really are, just like every member of the public, ready for reform and concede that the system's broken and would be happy to be done with it. They're not yet a majority, and that will be, again, our job to build support among legislators. But I think part of it also is you have to remember that this system, as we were saying earlier, started in 1977, and there's only 2 remaining legislators, John Pinto and Nick Salazar, who were in the legislature in 1977. So many of these legislators, this is the only system they've ever known. And they're not really aware that other states do it differently, and they've become enamored of this process. It's what they're used to. So I think part of it, a little bit of it, is, well, this is the way we've always done it, so it must be the right way to do it. And so that's what we're up against.
You have, at Think New Mexico, a really amazing track record when you look at the other bills that you have advocated for and one. Can you tell us about some of those victories from the past?
Sure, and thank you for that question. I think we're best known for enacting a full-day kindergarten law back then. This was 1999. We just had half-day kindergarten in New Mexico, which was sort of primitive. And so the hard part of that project was just finding the revenue to pay for moving from half-day kindergarten to full-day kindergarten. So we put out a report on how to pay for it and pointed out that the cost of moving from half-day to full-day was the equivalent of 1% of the general fund, which back then was only $32 million. So we did a report that was a lot of fun, where we profiled 22 different projects that were sort of similar to this, that were redundant, non-essential. But that was from the general fund and using general fund dollars, and pointed out that if we just reallocated resources, we could pay for this without expanding the size of government or raising taxes. Gary Johnson was then the governor. And so we were able to convince the legislature that there was a sensible way to pay for this and that they wouldn't have to raise taxes. And most importantly, that it would benefit every child. And so now it's about 25,000 children in New Mexico have access to full-day kindergarten.
Were you able to pass the full-day kindergarten the first time it was proposed, or did it take years?
So we were able to pass it in the first year, but we needed additional classrooms. And so we had to come back every year for 5 years to get the appropriations to build the classrooms that many school districts needed.
What are some of the other victories that Think New Mexico has, initiatives that have been successful?
Well, the other big one that I think we're most well known for is repealing the tax on groceries. And that was that took 3 years of going back to the legislature every year. And it's a little bit like Rasputin, every time we think we got the bill through, and Repeatedly, we have had to beat back efforts to reinstate or reimpose the food tax. And that's a battle that we're still fighting. And with the help of a lot of your listeners, one year they brought it back, actually, when the Great Recession hit at the worst possible time. The legislature brought back the food tax, and we were able to generate about 15,000 emails to Governor Richardson in the week that followed that. And to his great credit, the governor paid attention to all those emails and line item vetoed the reimposition of the food tax. And we expect that there will be other efforts. There are still other legislators that are talking about doing gross receipts tax reform, but reimposing the food tax. And we're encouraging them to, by all means, reform our gross receipts tax system, but to leave the tax off of food so that we don't join the ranks of Mississippi and Alabama, which are the only two states that continue to fully tax groceries in their states.
We're talking to Fred Nathan from Think New Mexico. Another initiative that we've talked about on this program was reform of the Public Regulation Commission. Tell us about that.
Well, that's still a work in progress.
Yeah.
And again, with the help of you and many others, we were able to get three constitutional amendments on the ballot that essentially did two things. One is to take power away from the Public Regulation Commission, which at the time was the most powerful state regulatory body in the country. They had jurisdiction over insurance, as well as what they have today, which is mostly rate making for utilities like telephones and PNM. And so two amendments took away the Department of Insurance and the Corporate Reporting Unit. That's been very successful. The Department of Insurance now is more insulated from politics, and they are running, I think most people would say, much better without the PRC's involvement. The second unit was a corporate reporting unit that had a 120-day backlog. This is a very ministerial function, and the constitutional amendment put them over at the Secretary of State's office, which also does some corporate reporting unit. They were combined into a single unit, and the backlog has gone from 120 days. Now it's same day. You file your paperwork and you get a receipt. And also, because of the backlog, the PRC invented a filing fee, an expedited filing fee, which they had no authority to do under statute, of like $300. And now everybody pays the same thing, which I believe is $30 or $50. So those are victories. The third constitutional amendment, which the voters passed, thankfully, now requires that you have some sort of qualification to serve on the PRC. At the time, you just had to be 21 years of age and not a convicted felon, which we didn't really think was enough qualifications to serve on the PRC. Now it's sort of a sliding scale that combines the things that you would expect, for example, in the private sector, some appropriate relevant educational background and some work qualifications. That you know, is going to take some time, because the PRC is elected over, there's five of them, and they're not all elected at the same time. So that's going to take some time to get candidates that are more qualified. But I think over time, it will be effective.
That has not applied yet to the people who are on it now?
So we had to grandfather in the current commissioners. And so that'll take some time to work its way through the system. But eventually, we look forward to more highly qualified PRC commissioners.
I think all of this is an illustration of the reality that so much of what makes our lives go smoothly is stuff that we never think about. And it's stuff that is like what you're doing, is nerdy, wonky people having ideas, talking about them, putting things in place that, it's like, it's sort of like we don't know how our car, most of us don't know how our car works either, but some cars work well and some don't, and the old models eventually get scuttled, and you get a car that drives you to where you need to go. You have no idea how an engine works. And it's the same in government. And it's, I think it's important to know. It's important to talk about these things. It's important for citizens who are paying our taxes and being part of it to have some understanding of what the nuts and bolts and gears are of our government. But, you know, we do take it for granted and we do have expectations, but making it work right, it's not easy.
It's not easy. And it's true. We like looking under the hood and that stuff interests us. And we are always reminding ourselves that the public is much busier and not as interested in the inner workings of state government. But you're right, you know, something like public infrastructure, and I'm a policy wonk, I never really appreciated how much goes into that and how important it is to our daily lives. You know, every time you turn on the faucet, we're affected by the Christmas tree bill when we drive on state roads. You know, I have a much greater appreciation now for, you know, first of all, how expensive those things are and how important it is that we spend that money that we have intelligently. And that's another interesting aspect to all of this is when you look at these rankings, Mary Charlotte, where we're 49th or 50th, many of them can be traced back to the fact that we're simply a poor state. In this particular issue of public infrastructure spending, because we are so fortunate in New Mexico to benefit from oil and gas and so forth, we actually have a lot of money. It's, as I said earlier, it averages about $300 million a year that we borrow against those severance taxes. And that's a lot of money. And really all we lack in terms of going from the bottom to the top on capital infrastructure spending is the political will to move to a merit-based system from a very hyper-political system. And that this is a great example of how we could go from last to first.
How can listeners to this program and citizens of New Mexico make their voices heard about this during the coming legislative session, which starts on, what is it, the 19th or 20th of January?
The 19th of January. Thank you for that question. I'd encourage them to go to our website. They can learn more about this issue. And we also have something on our website, www.thinknewmexico.org. We have an action center where you can contact your legislators. You don't even need to know who they are. You just type in your address and the computer figures that out for you. And there's a we try to make it as easy as possible. There's a pre-scripted letter that listeners can send, but it's we encourage you to edit those letters and put it into your own words. And I think legislators appreciate that more than one of these formulaic letters. And we see some of these letters and the public really does a very good job of contacting the legislators, and they many times more persuasive than we are. And the wonderful thing about the system is it doesn't require a stamp. You know, you can send it, you write one letter and it goes to both your state senator, your state representative, and the governor and the lieutenant governor. So we try to make it quick and easy.
Is this something that our Republican governor would be in favor of? Do you have a sense of that?
You know, I haven't had the opportunity to speak with her about it, but we appreciated that in the news reports when we first came out with this report, some people in the media spoke with her about it, and she said she would add it to the call. She didn't specifically endorse our bill, which hadn't been drafted then, but we took it as a very encouraging sign that, and your listeners may not be aware of some of this, but in a 30-day session, which is every even year, it's generally considered to be a budget session. And if you want to have something considered that's not budgetary, you have to get a message, what's called a message from the governor, to put it on her call. And so we're thrilled that she's already agreed to do that.
It's kind of budgetary, isn't it?
You know, we don't want to have that fight, so it's easier to get a message from the governor. But I think you're right that even if we didn't get a message, I think we could make the argument that it's germane because it does affect dollars and cents.
Fred Nathan is executive director of Think New Mexico, an independent public policy think tank located right here in Santa Fe. The web address is thinknewmexico.org. Fred, thank you so much for being with us again here on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.